And tonight we're going to be talking about the Holocaust. But not just a discussion of the Holocaust. Tonight we're going to have two people here, one on the line and one in studio. First, before we get to the Mr. Breitbar, who is on the phone waiting for us, let me introduce who's going to come aboard about 7:20. Gentleman's name is Mark Weber. And Mark Weber is a member of the Editorial Advisory Committee of the Institute for Historical Review. Basically, his contention is, and I'll introduce him a little bit more later, is that the Holocaust never really existed. That the Holocaust is a PR scam devised by Jews for whatever reason. We'll find out later what the contention is. And that many of the contentions that are made up by the Jewish community simply don't exist. That it is all a figment of one's imagination. And we have on the line Aaron Breitbar of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, senior researcher of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Aaron, are you on the line?
Good evening. How are you?
Good evening. Thank you aboard. Before we go on, I want to make it very clear that what Mark Weber did, in fact, Aaron, want to debate you, and you elected not to appear on the same show with Mr. Weber, and I would like to ask you why.
Basically, because we choose not to dignify the types of thoughts and those who espouse them. And for that reason, we have a very strong policy that if anybody asks us questions before, we will answer them. If anybody asks us questions afterwards, we will answer them. But we will not go on with these people for the same reason that Jonas Salk will not go on with a voodoo witch doctor to discuss the causes of infantile paralysis or polio. It only dignifies people and theories who do not deserve it.
All right, but the reality is that the revisionists have gotten more and more press. Because we are a free society, because these kinds of radio shows obviously enjoy having this kind of controversy on, it's going to happen more and more. I'm not making a judgment here, and I accept the fact that you don't want to appear. So let me do this. Let's spend the next 10 or 15 minutes with you, if you would. You know more about the contentions of Mark Weber than I do. I'm sure you know him very well. Let's spend a few minutes, if you would, telling me. Before I do that, let me ask you what you would like to say, knowing he's going to spend a good hour and a half with us here, and you're not going to be here to refute the contentions that he is going to argue.
Well, you know, it's a very long story, but the fact is, as long as there are people in the world that are ready to listen to Men from Mars stories, there'll be people equally as ready to tell them. The fact, however, is that I believe these individuals to have a much more pernicious agenda. As far as I'm concerned, they are tailoring anti-Semitism to fit the times. There was a time where people believed that Jews used blood for Passover, then Hitler came along with the theory, having to doctor it to fit modern times, that the Jews were trying to poison the genetic pool of German and European blood. And now you have a group of people who basically say, the Jews are liars, despite all the proof of the Holocaust and the various people that have been involved, either as participants, as victims, the jurists, the newspaper people, what have you. Despite all of that proof, they say that the Holocaust is basically a myth manufactured by Jews for the support of a Jewish state, which would not have existed without it, and that this Jewish state has as its goal expansion, and it's almost the Jewish conspiracy theory, the Jews are trying to take over the world, but it's tailored for modern times. Bigotry comes in 57 varieties, just like Heinz, and this is just one of the newer ones. What these individuals, I believe, are trying to do is to rehabilitate Nazism and other extremist right-wing ideologies so that 50 years after the event, when memories are dulled, people will one day believe that maybe the Nazis really didn't do all that people said about them. Maybe the Nazis were just another political party who simply made the trains run on time. And I believe that if we are not careful and take to heart the lessons of history, there is a danger, of course, of repeating them. And that is precisely what these individuals are looking for. They were not able to go around in the 40s and in the 50s and say this thing never happened. There were just too many people around who saw it happen. But 60% of the world's population was born after the war, and in a society where half the high school students in this country cannot identify where New York State is, they are hoping that people will find these stories too difficult to be believed, and by the same token that they will be so uninformed that it'll be easy to take facts that seem like facts to twist them around. One of the most obvious, for example, and I'm sure Mr. Weber will try to bring it up, is the fact that recently the Polish government at the Auschwitz Memorial in Poland downgraded the figures of those who were murdered there from 4 million to a little bit over 1 million, and they'll say, aha, they're finally giving in little by little. But what they will not want to tell you is the fact that the 4 million figure was never accepted by the majority of historians. If you take a look at the Encyclopedia Judaica, published in 1971, before there was an Institute for Historical Review, etc., they will tell you that the lower estimates are the more correct ones. They will talk about gas chambers. Were there gas chambers in Dachau or not? The fact of the matter is there were gas chambers at Dachau. They were operational, except for the fact that there was a very strong resistance in the camp, which constantly sabotaged them, which is true, by the way, for Buchenwald. And they will try to get people who may not know exactly what happened. They will bring up a report, for example, known as the Leuchter Report, a report of an individual who, by the way, is in trouble with the law right now, who basically went to the Auschwitz camp and the Majdanek camp and tried to prove, because there was not that much Zyklon B, the gas that was used there, that he could find some 45 years after the event, that proved that it could not have been used to kill people. And yet, at the trial in which he gave this testimony, he was ripped apart by the prosecution. That was the Zundel case in Canada.
Yeah, let me ask you, can I call you Aaron?
That's fine.
Do you have any religious background? Are you a rabbi?
No, I'm not.
Good. So that makes me feel better. I can call you Aaron. One of the contentions of his organization is that, of course, there was no mention by Hitler or any of the hierarchy about the actual extermination of the Jews. And if memory serves me, and I am not a Holocaust expert nor a historian, the Wannsee Conference of the early 40s, did it not specifically talk about the extermination of the Jews?
January 20th, 1942, Gross Wannsee of Berlin, that is absolutely correct.
And the term extermination of the Jews was used during that conference, was it not?
In the conference it was. Now, one has to understand, however, that they had to be very careful. For example, they said that Jews will no longer be allowed to emigrate. Instead, they are going to be evacuated. Now, obviously, if the purpose of the Nazis, the point of the Nazis was to get the Jews out of Europe, they would have been happy to let them go wherever they wanted, which, of course, was the original plan. However, we do know that the word evacuate means killing. Why? Because the term evacuering was used at a mental hospital, and what happened was evacuering then meant the killing of the mental patients, which is another fact that I would like to bring out for just a moment. The first people murdered en masse by the Nazis were not Jews. They were German mental patients, people that were considered unworthy of life because either they were mentally infirm or physically infirm, they were crippled. At least 100,000 of these people were murdered, were so-called euthanized, and I hate that word, but they were murdered at places like Hadamar, Hartheim, Brandenburg, Grafenegg, Sonnenstein, etc. The point is that the people who manned those stations were the ones who eventually taught others and who themselves were involved in the places like Majdanek, Sobibor, Auschwitz, Birkenau. So this Holocaust is not simply a Jewish question. It's a question of humanity. There were millions of other people that were murdered because they were considered not to be worthy of life. And there were many people who risked their lives and very often gave them, whether they were in Eastern Europe or in Germany or countries in Western Europe, because they could not see man, could not sit down while man was being inhuman to his fellow man. So this is an issue that is extremely important, not only to Jews, but to the world at large, because the Jews were not the first people ever targeted. We had the Armenians in 1915. In Cambodia, some 2.5 million people were murdered in the 70s by Pol Pot. And so this is an issue that we as human beings, forget Jew, Gentile, German, Russian, whatever you have, that's something that we as human beings must contend with, because man has been inhumane to his fellow man, and we must never let this happen again. That's why the center was constructed, not simply to memorialize the victims of the Holocaust as good a purpose as that may be, but to work to educate the public and to see that social action is accomplished, to see that inhumanity, violation of rights, regardless of who the victim is, who the perpetrator is, cannot go on. It must stop.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Aaron Breitbar, who would not debate Mark Weber, who will be with us momentarily talking about the Holocaust. Did it exist? Did it not? As he, a revisionist, contends that it did not exist. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Well, I assume you have, and I'm going to start with you, Mark. You've been up against the Simon Wiesenthal Center before, and their contention is that this is, your position is so ludicrous that it's basically the Flat Earth Society, Men from Mars type of thing. You are very serious about the fact the Holocaust didn't exist.
Well, Bill, I think it's inaccurate to use that kind of term. And early on, you characterized that our position is that we say the Holocaust is a figment of imagination. That's not correct at all.
Okay.
There's no question, and nobody disputes the fact that millions of Jews were uprooted from their homes in Europe, that they were deprived of their rights, they were treated very cruelly. They were deported en masse to concentration camps and ghettos in the east, where many of them died under often terrible overcrowding. There's no question that at least hundreds of thousands of Jews died during the Second World War. Many Jews were killed. But we say, and when I say we, I mean Holocaust revisionists. Holocaust revisionism is a growing field, movement, whatever you want to say. It's characterized by Professor Robert Forson of the University of Lyon in France, Dr. Arthur Butts of the Northwestern University, the best-selling British historian David Irving, and even Dr. Arno Meyer, professor of history at Princeton University. What we say are three things. First, there was no plan or program by the German government during the Second World War to exterminate the Jews of Europe. That does not mean, as I say, that many Jews didn't die. It doesn't mean that many Jews were not even killed in various circumstances. Second, we say that the figure of 6 million Jewish dead during the war is an irresponsible exaggeration. It's in fact not supported anymore by responsible historians, no matter what their view of this subject. And third, we say that stories of mass extermination in gas chambers are mythical. Now, let's get down to some specifics. Mr. Breitbart said, for example, that we would make the point, I mean, he made the point that the figure held for many years of 4 million Auschwitz dead has been reduced, as it were, officially to 1 million. And he contended that no historian ever really supported the 1 million figure. Well, Rabbi Marvin Heyer of the Simon Wiesenthal Center himself, about a year ago on a program, claimed 4 million were killed at Auschwitz, 2.5 million of those were Jews. Okay. No responsible historian now accepts that figure.
Let me ask you, let's assume that it's 1 million. Okay? I mean, well, do you accept that 1 million were killed at Auschwitz?
No. In fact, 1 million figure that's now talked about is a figure of how many are estimated to have died at Auschwitz.
To have been at Auschwitz, not to have died.
Okay, well, anyway.
That was Ted, by the way, O'Keefe.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. But the point is this, the important point is this, that the Auschwitz 4 million figure isn't something that just was just in the air. It was certified at the main Auschwitz, main Nuremberg trial of 1945-46. It's been repeated countless times in numerous history books, newspaper articles, and by spokesmen, even including from the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And the important thing is that this 4 million figure had was supported by a whole lot of so-called documentation, eyewitnesses, and so forth, and that evidence, and Mr. Breitbart implicitly concedes, is no good. Now, he went on to talk about how we would say that no one was gassed at Dachau and Buchenwald and other camps in Germany proper. What's important to realize is that the main Nuremberg trial and at many other trials and so forth, it was claimed seriously the masses of people were exterminated in gas chambers at Dachau, Buchenwald, Sachsenhausen, and other camps in Germany proper. That part of the Holocaust extermination story is now conceded to be so untenable that that has been eliminated. And Mr. Breitbart, in his sort of roundabout way, conceded that. But what's the important thing is that the evidence supposedly that was presented for these supposed gassings at Dachau and so forth, he implicitly acknowledges to have been worthless. That is, eyewitnesses, court testimony, documentation, and so forth, for gassings at Dachau, he concedes implicitly are not true.
Well, I don't think he did that. I think what he said was that there were gassings at Dachau.
No, he said there were gas chambers, but that the resistance was so powerful they were able to prevent them.
No. He didn't say that. He said that there were nearly as many. And that's what I remember, and there was a lot of opposition within the camp, but there were gassings that were going on. The problem is I'm at a disadvantage here because I don't have the information to debate you, as does the Simon Wiesenthal Center.
Sure.
And I'm almost, uh, uh, it's, it's, it's somewhat upsetting here.
Bill, whatever the situation, it's now there's now no question. No one was ever gassed at Dachau. That is now firmly established.
And they had gas chambers at Dachau.
Wait a minute. We're talking oftentimes about two different things. When you go to Dachau today, there's a crematory facility there. There's a room that is presented to the public at saying that this was at one time a gas chamber, but no one was ever gassed there. Now, we can go into various reasons, which I might go into later, why that wasn't. But nearby are very small rooms, very small chambers, which were in fact gas chambers. They were used for gassing clothes. They were disinfection gas chambers using Zyklon B. One of the famous pictures of the door, a famous picture of the door of one of these chambers has been widely reproduced as the door of an alleged extermination gas chamber. That's false. Oftentimes, much of the confusion arises out of the fact that there's a confusion between real gas chambers that were in fact used. There were hundreds of them throughout Europe during the Second World War, used to disinfect clothes using Zyklon B. Zyklon B was a very common disinfectant.
You know what? We're going to take a break because we have to take a traffic break. We're going to come back and we're going to discuss the issue of whether in fact there were these gassings or not. We're discussing the Holocaust with two revisionists, and I assume that that's not pejorative as far as you're concerned. You accept those terms, right? With two Holocaust revisionists, Ted O'Keefe, the editor of the Journal of Historical Review, Mark Weber, director of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. We haven't given the numbers out, but I'll tell you the lines are already jammed. As you can imagine, this is a very, very controversial issue. I have not yet brought out, gentlemen, and I want to know, and I've sort of left it for the half hour, I am Jewish. Mm-hmm. My grandparents were killed in the Holocaust. I don't have grandparents because they were exterminated by the Ustashi, the Yugoslav Nazis. My father today spent 4 hours at the Simon Wiesenthal Center, coincidentally, by the way, 4 hours in front of a videotape camera explaining his experience at the Jasenovac concentration camp where he witnessed fellow Jews being slaughtered. Now, you may say it doesn't exist, but my dad ain't a liar. He was there. He saw it. Okay, he saw people being shot, killed, men, women, and children lined up against walls and shot because they were Jews. And to say that didn't happen doesn't make much sense. But my understanding is you're not arguing that people were not killed that way. You're just arguing the numbers here. Am I correct, Ted? Or is this whole thing a figment?
I think the Jasenovac concentration camp in what is now Yugoslavia is a good case in point because the current president of the Croatian Republic of Yugoslavia, a former communist and an Asturian, has authoritatively demonstrated that the figures for deaths in Jasenovac have been exaggerated by 7 to 10-fold.
I have a question.
Okay.
That doesn't make any sense. There were, I think, 75 or 90,000 Jews in Yugoslavia. 95% didn't make it through the war.
We say they didn't make it.
They all died, Ted.
But how do you know they all died?
Because none of them are around.
Bill, where did they go? Bill. First of all,
your father came to this country from Yugoslavia.
Yeah, he was one of the 10% who survived. But how about his uncles, his parents, his cousins? Out of the family of hundreds, there were three or four that made it just out of my family. How about the other families who lost hundreds? Go ahead.
One of the most interesting features when talking about the Holocaust is you ask an average American how many Jews died during the Second World War.
Right.
How many were killed? Everybody says 6 million.
Right.
Everybody's heard this figure. If you ask a person how many Americans died during the Second World War, how many Russians died during the Second
World
War, how many Germans died during the Second War, most people have not a clue of an idea.
I do. I'll tell you.
Now, wait a minute. Most people don't have a clue of an idea. Now,
right.
At the end of the Second World War, the last years and just after the Second World War, something like 14 million Germans were expelled or fled from what was then Eastern Germany and Eastern European provinces into Germany at the end of the war. Something like 2 million Germans died during that process. It was a terrible thing, an awful thing, but nobody contends that was not a policy to exterminate the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Whether people are killed or massacres that take place, that is not the same as a policy to exterminate people. Our contention is that there is no evidence of a German policy or program during the Second World War to exterminate the Jews of Europe. There's not only no documentary evidence of that, there's no evidence whatsoever. And the evidence that does exist, documents, memoirs, and so on and so forth, confirm that the German policy was to expel the Jews to the east, albeit under very horrendous circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And many died, and even many were shot. But that's not the same as a policy to exterminate the Jews of Europe. I want to give one of the most important pieces of evidence for the Auschwitz extermination story, confining just to Auschwitz, is a so-called memoir of Auschwitz Commandant Rudolf Höss, H-O-E-S-S. This memoir and the so-called Confessions of Rudolf Hess have now been shown to be fraudulent. He was tortured at the end of the war by the British. He claimed that 2.5 million or 3 million people were exterminated under his command at Auschwitz during the Second World War. No serious historian now accepts that figure. That's out. And the important thing, I want to get back to this earlier before, is that Mr. Breitbart, in his earlier thing, was trying to anticipate some of the points that we might make.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing is that in his statements, he implicitly repudiates a mountain of documents, so-called documents, eyewitnesses, and so forth for claims that were made seriously at the end of the war. For example, it was seriously claimed during the war and after the war and at the Nuremberg trials that Germans manufactured soap bars of soap, mm-hmm. and the bodies of murdered Jews. It's a story that had a lot of circulation at one time. No serious historian now. It's accepted. It's a myth. It's a propaganda story from the Second World War.
You know, I have seen photographs taken by the Allies. I have seen photographs of thousands of Jews in line marching into chambers and no one coming out the other end.
No. Maybe you've seen pictures of crowds of Jews. There is no pictures of gassings of people. There are no pictures of lines of people marching into a gas chamber.
These were identified by U.S. Army intelligence as gas chambers.
Wait a minute.
They were identified by our forces.
The only picture, there's one famous photograph, as far as I know, only one, by an American Army photographer of a gas chamber. It was taken at Auschwitz on Liberation Day, April 1945.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a photograph of Auschwitz taken from the air during reconnaissance.
Oh, very good.
Right?
Very good. Excellent. Excellent point.
And we are talking...
These aerial photographs were made public by the CIA in 1979. They were aerial photographs taken by the Allies during 1944, during the height of the alleged extermination period at Auschwitz. There is nothing in the photographs themselves that shows any evidence of masses of bodies, gas chamber, anything. What happened was that captions have been added to these photos to say this was a gas chamber, this was such and such, and this was so and so.
When you're at 20,000 feet or 15,000 feet and you're taking aerial photographs, there is nothing that says this is an armaments factory. There is nothing that says this building is barracks, this building houses military supplies. But intelligence knows where gas chambers were.
In fact, during the war, no American official, no Allied official, saw fit to say that those photographs show that anyone was gassed at Auschwitz.
Those labels were put on
30 years later. In fact, what is important about those photographs is that they are not consistent with numerous stories of flames shooting up from crematories, piles of bodies being ready to be disposed of, numbers of people.
The
photographs are not consistent with the Holocaust extermination story as we have heard it for 40 years. That's the important thing of those photographs.
Where did all the people go when they were brought in cattle cars in Auschwitz? Did those people don't exist?
What number of people? We were told up to a year ago that there were 4 million people brought to Auschwitz and killed.
I don't know the figure.
No, that's shrunk down by 3 million.
Fine.
Where did those 3 million go?
Let's accept your figure of 1 million. All right, assuming that you're correct, and I don't know. I don't know that for a fact. Assuming you're correct, where did 1 million people go? Because at the end of the war, there were only tens of thousands left at Auschwitz. Where did 1 million people go?
Do you want me to do that?
Please, answer.
Many people died at Auschwitz. There were several typhus epidemics at Auschwitz. One of the reasons that, in fact, there were crematory buildings there was because of the very high death rate. The large buildings, four large buildings were constructed in Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is alleged to be the Great Extermination Center, in early 1943. These buildings are alleged to be the extermination gas chambers. We now know that these buildings were, in fact, these crematories were built in response to a typhus epidemic in 1942. Conditions in Auschwitz, especially Auschwitz-Birkenau, were absolutely horrendous. Many people died there, particularly of typhus, particularly of diseases. That's a cruel thing, it's a terrible thing, and so forth, but it is not an extermination program.
The story of extermination started to come out in 1940, 1941.
No.
The Allies... Let me tell you, I know this because I know people who were involved when there was a movement begging the Allies to bomb the railroad lines to save the Jews, and the Allies refused to do it because it simply wasn't of importance strategically to stop those railroad cars. Why would they come up with those stories in 1941 and not after the war?
Very important point. No, actually, the extermination stories for Auschwitz began really of Auschwitz in 1944. The stories of extermination in general were 1942. The important thing is that the Allies refused to acquiesce to these demands because the Allied officials officials responsible for Jewish affairs in Europe during the Second World War did not accept privately those stories. That's
right.
A very important
You're
point.
Right. They didn't.
That
they're
in
ashamed.
Fact, well, in fact, there was a discussions and, in fact, objections to the propaganda that was being put out at that time.
Jill, first-time caller from Valencia. You're on KFI. Good afternoon or good evening, Jill.
Hi. Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
All right. I don't want to debate these guys because I really think they're off the wall, and it's kind of really scary what they're saying. But I just want to say that my family was killed over there, too. They did not die of any diseases. They were killed, my whole family.
By whom?
Excuse me?
Where specifically, Jill?
I don't know where specifically they were killed, but I know they were killed, and they had numbers, and they were taken into camps, and they were killed. And the only one that came out alive was my father. Now, the first time I've heard someone come and tell me that the Holocaust didn't exist happened to be 4 years ago, and I was in shock, and I did check it out, okay? And I found out that the 6 million figure is really not accurate. The truth is it was probably double the amount of Jews that were killed, if not more. Sure, there is no documentation because everything was burned and everything was destroyed. Of course, they're not going to go and advertise, hi, guys, I'm going to kill 6 million Jews today. I'm going to kill five today. Here, let the world know in headlines. Of course not. That's why there's no evidence that way.
Yeah, you know
but
what?
The evidence is there, okay? And there's a big monument in Israel, in New York, and in a lot of places in the world. There's evidence, there's pictures, and there is numbers, okay? For someone to say that the Holocaust didn't exist and they just didn't get killed, they died from diseases, why don't you come around and say, well, there was no slavery in the United States, all right? The slaves are just a figment of someone's imagination because now black people are coming out and saying that they want a state too, and they want to get some money for all the hardship that they suffered. So slavery never existed.
Yeah.
I mean, when time passes by and things disappear and there's no headlines to prove something, of course you can say anything you want.
All right.
And it's really scary for someone to come out and take history the way it happened.
Jill,
when millions of people suffered, never mind the ones that were killed. I think the ones that were killed were lucky because the ones that weren't killed were really the ones that suffered, like little children, and come out and say, that never happened. They weren't killed. They just died from diseases. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. And the scary thing about it is that people like you that say things like that, there were people out there, they don't know what happened, and they think it's true. Oh, yeah, that's right. Just weren't killed there. It was just maybe a million. Well, maybe they believe it's a million or 2 million, and that's not the point. The point is there were more than 6 million.
All right, Jill, thanks for the call. You guys want to respond?
Well, it's difficult to respond to that, but I mean, it's what she said. Well, I suppose there's numerous things to be said. First of all, I mean, she says not 6 million, but double
12,
that, 12
right.
million. I mean, that's ridiculous. No historian now accepts really the 6 million figure is.
Let me ask you something. Here's a question that I have, okay? And one of the things about the Germans and the way they did things is they're pretty meticulous people. I mean, we know that. And the story, and one thing I disagree with Jill is that she says that people don't talk about how many people were killed, and that, but they didn't keep records. They did.
Mm-hmm,
for example, there were records coming out of Auschwitz and other camps of the numbers of the thousands coming in, and there was one day in which 3,000 or 4,000 died of heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, or heart attacks. 3,000 or 4,000 in one day died of heart attacks.
Well, I think we're talking about two different things. I mean, if we're going to talk about official German records...
I'm talking about official German records.
No, okay, right. You mentioned earlier, for example, the Bonsai Conference
document.
The That's very important. It's a 16-page document. It's part of the Nuremberg record. And so, in fact, Breitbart was not very explicit on this point, but in fact, there's no mention of extermination in the document. More important, not only is there no mention of extermination...
But they do mention the final solution, certainly.
Wait a minute. That term is used time and time again. Very important, Bill. There was a German policy called the final solution. The final solution policy was spelled out in German documents during the war. But the final solution policy was also spelled out not as a policy of extermination.
Let me ask you something. I think they were somewhat careful. I mean, for historical purposes, we know that if you read Mein Kampf, for example, Hitler talks about getting rid of, wiping out, doing away with. He uses many euphemisms for not having Jews around.
I wouldn't say those are euphemisms.
Mein Kampf contains no reference to or even an allusion to exterminating Jews.
And I wish I had a copy of Mein Kampf here because I think you'd have a difficult time.
Well, in fact, Bill, that's a very common misnomer, that Mein Kampf has this blueprint supposedly for exterminating the Jews. It's completely untrue. And as Mr. Breitbart mentioned earlier on in the program, in fact, after Hitler took power, his policy was to encourage and then finally encourage Jews to leave Europe. Much of the problem, in fact, was that other countries wouldn't take Jews.
That's true. But I have to tell you, in the countries the Germans did take over, and for example, certainly the Balkan countries, the East European countries, where the Ustashi, for example, and my experience and my knowledge is with Yugoslavia because of my father and the studies that I've made, Jasenovic camp. I know that once the Germans had already invaded in 1942, you couldn't get out. Jews could not get out. Thank you. It's over. Goodbye. You could not leave the country.
Well, one thing, Bill, you're touching on is that the policy toward the Jews in various countries in Europe during the Second World War, which were part of the Axis alliance, including Croatia under the Ustashi, varied from place to place. The Ustashi was a much more anti-Jewish.
Oh, they were nuts.
Ruthlessly.
You know what? Let me take some calls. We got people that are just dying to talk to us, and it's my fault for talking too much. Conrad, first-time caller from Upland. You're on KFI.
Yes, sir. Listen, I've been listening now for decades and decades of this load of baloney that the Holocaust didn't happen. I was a member of the 14th Armored Division on detached service to the American Red Cross. And I was there. I was in the... Oh, excuse me. I was a soldier, but I was in the shower room. I was in the Jeep that was up on blocks on the rear wheels with the hose attached to one shower sprinkler inside the shower sprinkler, and I was inside of it. There were no dead bodies there at the time, but it was pretty close.
Where were you, sir?
I was in Dachau.
Okay. It's true that at the end of the war, many people claim that people were gassed at Dachau at the end of the war. It's now, no serious historian, when you go to Auschwitz today, no one seriously claims that anyone was gassed at Dachau. This was a story that was widely propagated. Look, ask yourself, if the Germans had actually been gassing people at Dachau, do you think that they would leave in existence an extermination chamber for gassing people for the Americans to find when they come? It's ridiculous.
Excuse me. I spent a considerable amount of time there, and I talked to the prisoners that were still there, and their thighs were about as fat as my wrist. They had been there.
Sir.
I asked them what happened to the ashes of all the people.
Mm-hmm.
They told me they were spread on surrounding farms.
Conrad?
All their boots and their hair and anything else that you could take from a dead body were in sheds.
All right, Conrad, we're going to take a break, but I want you to hang on, okay?
Okay.
And we're back at KFI AM 640, Bill Handel, and the subject is the Holocaust, and did it exist as the Jewish people say it did? Our guests are Ted O'Keefe, editor of the Journal Historical Review, and Mark Weber, director for Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, revisionists, those that say the Holocaust did not exist as public perception claims that it has. We had on the line Conrad, who, back on the phone. Hello, Conrad, you're back.
Yes, sir.
Let me reintroduce you. Conrad was at Dachau at the end of the war with the American forces, and you claim, or you say, and you saw gas chambers at Dachau, right, Conrad?
Yes, sir, I was in it.
You were in a gas chamber at Dachau.
Yes, sir.
All right, and I think Mark and or Ted had a response.
Yes, Conrad. Number one, isn't it odd that the United States, which had a Judge Advocate General's Corps and a War Crimes Division with its legal corps, did not carry out and publish a forensic report on any such gas chamber in Dachau? Number two, in fact, the United States military had a forensic pathologist, Dr. Charles Larson, who performed several thousand autopsies on concentration camp victims in the Americas area, from Buchenwald, Dachau, so forth. You did not find a single case of poisoning through gas. Revisionists concede, we don't make excuses for, we concede that thousands and tens of thousands of inmates of the concentration camps, particularly in the last months of the war, died of typhus,
starvation
of the diseases.
Yeah, but how about all these people who saw the gassings, who saw the capos, the people who took the bodies out of the gas chambers.
Okay,
is that all stories of thousands of people?
It's very important to know exactly what we're dealing with here. The number of people who say they actually saw gassings is very, very small. One of the most famous of these men, Rudolf Verba, who was a co-author of the so-called Auschwitz Protocol, who has written a book entitled I Cannot Forgive, testified against revisionists in Toronto. He had to concede at the end of his testimony that much of his book and much of his testimony and much of his statements over the year had been poetic license, had been fiction. He claimed personally to have witnessed the gassings of something like 2 million people at Auschwitz. No, as Mr. Breitbart said earlier, no serious historian accepts that anymore. When one tries, as I have tried to do and others have tried to do, to pin down these witnesses, well, what exactly did you see? Not what you heard from other people, what exactly did you see? These stories break down under close examination.
Conrad, we have 1 minute to go. Do you want to comment here?
Well, I tell you, I fought through Rhineland and Central Europe. And during that time, we freed a Frauenlager, a woman's jail. I watched reburials of dead from mass graves where they propped up the four dead bodies, half-eaten in caskets, and they made the people in the German town with their children walk through and have to observe them. I was in there myself. And as far as the gas chamber, I guarantee you, I saw the gas chamber, I saw the Jeep that made the gas, that the Volkswagen that was on blocks, and it was attached to the piping going in the building, and the whole building was very thick asbestos. I even know how the damn place was built. And I was in it all alone, and it was a pretty big building. And I said to myself, I wonder how many poor souls lost their life in here.
Right. Conrad, thank you.
I went out, put my hands in the barrels of ashes, and believe me, it wasn't from a fireplace.
Conrad,
it was from the ovens.
Thanks very much for the call. For those of you that are on hold, Jeff, Nancy, David, Joyce, we're taking a break right now. We will be back to your phone calls. We want them. They're important. We're speaking to Mark Weber and Ted O'Keefe, revisionists, Holocaust revisionists. We'll be back after this at KFI Los Angeles.
Mr. Weber, you're an idiot, and the only reason you got on this program is because you're controversial, because just listening to you talk for a minute shows that you're not very intelligent, you manipulate the facts, and I know something about concentration camps, because I am Japanese-American, and I was in one during World War II, and you're probably going to say that didn't happen.
Where's the gas chamber?
It doesn't have to be a gas chamber. I personally looked it up in the dictionary, and to incarcerate persons because they're a certain group, that's enough to call that a concentration camp.
Nancy, I don't think they're denying there were concentration camps.
No, in fact, Nancy, I've written an article about the West Coast incarceration of Japanese Americans during the Second World War. There were many similarities, in fact, although certainly nowhere near the brutality or the harshness of between the rounding up of Japanese Americans on the West Coast and the rounding up and incarceration of Jews in Europe during the Second World War.
Yes, I'm just trying to make a point. I have seen films of these mass graves. I've seen heads decapitated. I have seen arms and legs. I have seen films of this.
Terrific. Nancy, as a matter of fact, let me cut you off because I want to continue that thought, and thank you very much. Let's talk about the films that came out of World War II, the documentary films of the mass graves, of the Cyclone B being dropped in, of the piles of bodies sitting in the gas chamber.
In the final months of the war,
yes.
As the Soviets approached from the east, the Germans moved hundreds of thousands of Jews from concentration camps and remaining ghettos in the east into the remaining German camps in central and western Germany. The camps that were remaining in western central Germany became horribly overcrowded, absolutely stuffed with people. And under these circumstances, especially with the vast movement of people during that period of time, there was a great deal of death in these camps by starvation and disease. There's no secret about that. Everyone knows about that.
How about the photographs of inside the gas chamber that I have seen of hundreds of bodies piled up towards the middle? I mean, were these doctored?
No,
were these manufactured?
There are no photographs of bodies of gassed people.
I have not seen those?
No. You might have seen photographs of bodies. And there's no question. I mean, many, many people died in these camps. In fact, if there had been a German policy to exterminate the Jews of Europe during the Second World War, the masses of people that were found in the Western camps at the end of the war would have long since been killed. Wouldn't have been there.
And maybe my memory is going here, but I distinctly remember seeing photographs a large room with bodies piled up in a pyramid.
Probably the photograph you're talking about is at Dachau. Right. There's a picture of bodies, and they were waiting to be cremated. Nobody contends that those bodies were gassing victims, though. All that's right. Not seriously claimed.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Jeff, first-time caller from Malibu. Jeff, welcome to KFI.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Fine. Please, join us.
Bill, I'm 23 years old, and I too am a Jew, and I tend to have very emotional ties to this. Although my family wasn't in the Holocaust like yours, we came here at the turn of the century, and we immigrated through Ellis Island, and a lot of the knowledge we have of the Holocaust is, it's hearsay, as you might say, but nonetheless, this is what we've heard. I have like 3 points I'd like to make if I can.
Sure, please do.
First of all, I just want to say I'm a little bit upset that the Simon Wiesenthal people did not appear to debate, because I find that the views being put forth by Mr. Weber are so outrageous that they need to be countered by somebody from the center in order to sort of balance it out in a way, because it just, no matter how outrageous certain views seem to be, it's very important to always counter them, because, I mean, everybody thought that Hitler was very outrageous as well, and they just discounted him, and, you know, look what happened, and not... I mean, if it wasn't for Hitler, we wouldn't be having this debate right now, I guess. The second thing is, the best people to talk to about whether or not the Holocaust really happened, the Jews are, a lot of Jewish people are calling in, but if you really want to know what really happened there, maybe it would be important to talk to the Nazis, because the Nazi party today is very proud of the fact that the Holocaust happened, and they don't dispute it at all. And the reason why they're not calling in right now, and the reason why they're not disputing Mr. Weber, is because they're happy that there's somebody like Mr. Weber that's disputing the existence of the Holocaust, because they're waiting for it to happen again. They're waiting for us to forget about it so they can make their move. And I think that, and because of that, I feel that people like Mr. Weber are much more threatening to Jews today than the Nazis ever were, because if this kind of disinformation propagates, a new Holocaust could very much be inevitable. Anti-Semitism is a result of the distortion of facts, and it's happened throughout history. Modern Christian anti-Semitism always focused on the death of Jesus. And it was always said that the Jews killed Jesus, and 25 years ago we were absolved of this. And but nonetheless, this tradition seemed to have been programmed into the religion, and many Jews died because of it. Islamic anti-Semitism kind of centered on the Jews somehow forged the Bible, and now we have this. You know, I mean, this is just ridiculous. I'm just beside myself.
You made your point. Jeff, thank you very much for the call. I have a question before you respond to Jeff, okay? And I'm trying to remember what I have seen, okay? I'll tell you else something that I've seen distinctly, clearly, that you cannot tell me I didn't see it. I have seen films of men, women, and children naked, lined up in pits, and shot. Hundreds and hundreds of men, women, and children killed at pits. I have seen those films.
Well, there were some shootings of Jews in the Soviet, in the occupied Soviet territories. That's true. There's no question of that. I mean, but look, we've also seen pictures of Vietnamese who were killed in massacres in Vietnam. That doesn't mean that there was an American policy to exterminate the people of Vietnam.
Okay, so you're not disputing the fact that the atrocities happened. The basic contention is that it didn't happen on a mass governmental scale with a plan to exterminate a whole group of people.
Bill, what we say are three things. It's not just we. There's professors, doctors, scholars. Mm-hmm. This subject who say three things. First, there was no policy or program by the German government to exterminate the Jews of Europe during the Second World War. Second, the figure of 6 million exterminated Jews during the war is an irresponsible exaggeration. It's not true. I mean, there's no. Third, we say that stories of mass extermination in gas chambers are not true. Those are the 3 points we make.
Ready to take some more phone calls. Anything you want to...
Yeah.
You haven't had a chance much to talk to these people, so...
I'd like to respond to the previous caller.
Please do, Ted.
He was quite illogical. He said, first of all, that our views were so outrageous, whereby you'd think they just collapse out of their own nonsense. But then he wished there had been someone to debate us. Wished that Mr. Breitbart had deigned to debate us, meaning evidently we're not so outrageous. Secondly, he claimed, he talked about anti-Semitism. I think it's an insult. He talked about Nazis. He talked about a future Holocaust that we were going to start. Nothing is to us more ridiculous than the notion that by putting the facts of World War II straight, the non-Jews, the Gentiles of America, or anywhere else in the world, are going to rush out and kill all the rest of the Jews. It's ridiculous. In fact, it's insulting to Americans to claim that by putting historical facts straight, you're going to start a massive pogrom.
Why do you do it then? You know, why do you make your living?
There's two reasons, I think, to say that. First of all, the obvious reason that we want historical accuracy. We want truth in history. Mm-hmm. Second, but more than that, there's no question that the Holocaust story has assumed an enormous importance in American social, public, cultural life. It's talked about constantly. There's an agency of the United States government called the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, a taxpayer-supported, funded organization that is devoted to this thing. The Holocaust story has acquired an enormous importance in American public political life. The U.S. government and the 50 state governments every year are involved in things. We believe that this is entirely outrageous. It's outrageous to focus on the fate of the Jews during the Second World War as a metaphor for all of humanity. And what we think is even worse is that increasingly over the years, not merely Hitler or the Nazis or even the Germans are blamed for this, but the entire non-Jewish world is held collectively responsible for this crime.
And now let's get back to the phones with David, first-time caller from San Bernardino. David, you're on KFI.
Hi, Bill. How you doing?
I'm great.
Good. Gentlemen, now, at the beginning of the show, I think I remember somebody saying that the reason that this Holocaust, quote, myth by you guys has been told is because one reason was to get the Jewish state of Israel.
In fact, Bill Handel said that, and Aaron Breitbart sort of implied that. That's not what we say. The Holocaust story of extermination of Jews began during the Second World War as Allied propaganda. There are many people who have an interest in the Holocaust extermination story. It's not just a Jewish invention or anything like that. That's a wrong way to characterize it. It's clear, though, of course, the State of Israel, that the Holocaust story is very important for the State of Israel. Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, and so forth have on numerous occasions justified policies of the Israeli government by making references to the Holocaust. We believe that's their own business, but what we think is very, very wrong is to use the Holocaust as a sort of a part of American political life. For example, if a person says, well, I don't believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ, nobody seems to mind. But if a person says, well, I don't really believe that 6 million Jews were killed during the war, people have been dismissed from their teaching position. I mean, all sorts of things have happened to people who question this dogma. This is an icon in America. The Holocaust story has become a kind of almost quasi-religious icon in our society, and we believe that that's wrong. The Holocaust story does have, as a number of Jewish writers have made the point explicitly, has a political, social dimension.
It's worth pointing out in a number of other societies said to be democratic, such as West Germany, France, and Canada even, that doubting or challenging the Holocaust is a crime.
Why is Germany still paying reparations to the State of Israel for the Jews that were killed?
Well, I've written an essay, in fact, on that subject, and it's a very interesting thing. But, I mean, one of the things that the West German government pays money, both the State of Israel and to individual Jews around the world.
You bet.
On the basis of the actions against the policies, German policies against the Jews. This sets, I believe, a very, very dangerous precedent of collective guilt for actions. Most of the people paying this money, of course, are people who were not alive even during the Second World War. Money paid to the State of Israel is paid to a country that wasn't even in existence at the time of the Second World War. You had a caller a few evenings ago on this program by a man when Joe Crummy was here who wanted compensation for slavery.
Right.
And Joe Crummy and others disagree with him. But one of the reasons they disagree because they disagree with this principle of collective guilt, that a group of people who isn't even personally responsible for an action somehow should be held accountable.
Let me argue, though. Let me ask you this, okay? You say the Holocaust doesn't exist and you have some proof and you claim to have some proof and you certainly have some theories. But let's go to the other end, all right? The reason there is a collective guilt, because obviously to the Germans, the Holocaust is a very real thing. Otherwise, they wouldn't be paying the reparations. They obviously believe the Holocaust occurred.
When the entire discussion began in Germany in 1953 about this reparations business, Konrad Adenauer, who was chancellor at the time, made it clear later in his memoirs that it was essential to pay this as a a key to good relations with the West. That the only
wait a second, you really believe that? In the meantime, Germany's being built up on the Marshall Plan. Money is being poured in. The U.S. State Department doesn't give a damn about Jews. I gotta tell you, it took my dad 11 years to come into this country. My dad he applies to come into this country in 1945 and claims he is a victim of the Holocaust. Now I believe him because he's my father and I know he's not a liar. So you know what the U.S. State Department does? Too bad, Mr. Handel. We don't want Jews in here. So he
said that. Does he have a document to that effect?
Excuse me, it only took him 11 years to get into the quota system.
Well
11 years, Ted.
People,
11 years. No, no one
was
said...
Was there a right to come into the United States at that time?
Well, let me tell you, if there was, you're talking about how Germany felt that it would be important to the West. The West didn't care about Jews.
In fact, it was the U.S. government that told the German government at that time that it was important to pay reparations of some kind to Jews in order to... make good relations with the United
then
States.
Then why weren't Jews let in the United States?
I don't know.
Well, actually, a lot were. Don't generalize from your father's experience.
Very few were let in. You know, I'll tell you who was let in without any problem. Germans were let in, who worked at Peenemünde were brought in, scientists were brought in. But I'm talking about immigrants after the war simply weren't allowed in. The United States just shut it down.
One reason that more Jews were let in because Zionist organizations wanted Jews going from Europe to Israel, not to the United States. And there was a policy by the Zionist organizations at that time to channel Jews, as it were, from Europe at the end of the war, people who survived the camps,
An awful lot of Jews wanted to come to the United States and were not let in.
Okay, there is some truth to that. And in fact, as I said, Zionist organizations prefer that they go to Israel, just as today Zionist organizations wish that Soviet Jews would go to Israel rather than the United States.
But let me go back in terms of the collective guilt, and I want to discuss something. If one believes the Holocaust existed, and a lot of people do, I mean, you are in the minority, you have to agree with that. What do you see wrong with the collective guilt of a country that did this to another people, and reparations should not be paid? Now, let's take the other side. Now, take the side of a belief in the Holocaust, and then tell me what is wrong with reparations if one believes that it did exist.
Bill, the reason I believe it's wrong is because there's no end to it. There's no end to the number of people around the world whose ancestors have been persecuted.
No, not ancestors. Talk about people that are alive today.
Well, wait a minute. The money that's paid through the reparations from West Germany is not confined just to people who were personally affected by the Holocaust.
Oh, I think it is.
Wait a minute. It's paid. Money is paid to Israel as a country.
I understand. And that's for a period of time.
It goes on for quite a long time. It's been already 50 years since 19. But second of all, The whole point of collective guilt is a very dangerous one. Who pays? Should Germans pay who were born at the end of the war? What about Germans who live in Germany whose parents, for example, were opposed to Hitler?
Tell me this, Bill. Do you believe that Israeli Jews share a collective guilt for dispossessing the Palestinians?
No.
Perhaps if you did, you'd extend that collective guilt to the Germans for sending all that money to Israel to help the dispossession.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Joyce, first-time caller from Los Angeles. Joyce, you're on KFI.
Hi, I wanted to ask those people, what's the reason, for them to go ahead and, do all those things and try to convince people that the Holocaust will never exist and all those things?
I think they gave the reason, but I'll let them give it again. Gentlemen?
What
are your reasons for doing what you do?
Well, truth is one. I mean, obviously. I mean, all of us at one time, believed in the 6 million, that 6 million Jews were exterminated during the war. And through my own investigation and others, we came to the conclusion this is not true. That's one thing. The second is that the Holocaust story is used as a political mallet in our society, a political bludgeon for political social purposes. And we believe that's wrong. We believe that's wrong that in our society...
To start it, two people on your own, just go ahead and do it and try to convince people around the world that it's not true and try to search about it.
Well, ma'am, there are people, those who take the view that we do are not confined to just us. There's scholars around the world. I mean, some of them Jewish, in fact.
Can I ask you another question?
Yes, ma'am.
Were you alive at the time of the Holocaust?
No, I was not, ma'am.
Okay. There are so many people around the world that were alive around the Holocaust just like my grandmother, and she's still alive. And she was telling me story when I was a little girl still. She lives now in France, and when I was a little girl, she was telling me all kinds of stories about the Holocaust, which I believe her, because there is no reason for her to tell me as a little girl all those stories. Mm-hmm. And then later on, when I came to America, I hear the exact same stories from other people that are still
Ma'am.
Alive.
That's a good point, Joyce. Let's go ahead.
It's very possible.
Let's talk about the different stories. Go ahead.
Your grandmother may be telling the absolute truth. I don't know what she actually told you. But what that does not... When one means by the Holocaust that the Jews were persecuted, they were rounded up, they were put in camps, they died, that they were put in ghettos and so forth, we don't say that that's not true. That's not what we say at all. And your grandmother, I'm sure, and many other Jews who were in Europe during the Second World War underwent oftentimes a very horrendous treatment. But that's not what we say. We say that there was no policy or program to exterminate the Jews of Europe during the Second World War.
Well, part of the point is we haven't heard whether her grandmother experienced or witnessed anything. There are millions and tens of millions of Americans alive today who have seen things on newsreel. They're completely wrong and believe them absolutely implicitly. Furthermore, they'll tell you they were virtually eyewitnesses.
All right. We're going to come back, and we'll let you respond some more. We're going to get some more phone calls here. So Sharon calling from Lancaster. Hello, Sharon. You're on KFI.
Hi, Bill. I'm a Jew, and I would like nothing better than to revise the fact that 1 million or 5 million Jews died during the Holocaust. I would like to revise the fact that my mother, being one of 15 children, was one of 3 survivors. My father, one of 6, who was one of 2 survivors. Their wives, my aunts and uncles, their wives and children also did not survive. A 15-year-old female cousin was sterilized and made into a prostitute, and it was witnessed by a survivor. She and her mother, stripped naked, walked into a shower and never walked out again. Nothing these men can say will ever make me believe that they died of any illness, nor any of the other nearly 50 members of my family that were exterminated by Hitler. Because of this, I have read many, many volumes on Hitler and on the people under him, Eichmann, Mengele, everybody. There was a plot. These people were gassed. They were shot. They were experimented on, and these men are dangerous. I was 47 years old when you came on the air with these men, and I feel 67 now, and I'm scared to death.
All right, Sharon, thanks. Gentlemen, I assume you get a lot of that, don't you?
Oh, yeah. 96 people died in the family and so forth.
Well, it's not
necessarily true. These figures are very imprecise. You talked earlier, Bill, about the Germans keeping meticulous records.
Wait a second. Why would someone, say 45 cousins in our family and 3 survive? Why would someone make up a figure and say it was only 12 cousins? Why would you want to add cousins that didn't exist, Ted? I mean, you know how many cousins you have.
The nice
you know how many uncles you have.
The nice answer is that somehow during the war and after the war, a number of people who survived were lost track of. A nastier answer, which can't be excluded, is that some people exaggerate.
Well, another possibility is that maybe she did lose those relatives during the war.
Right.
For any number of reasons.
Right, and they could have died by illness.
For any number of reasons.
But there are an awful lot of people out there who lost an awful lot of relatives.
That's very true.
I mean, millions and millions if you track it all down. I mean, Yad...
In many countries during the war.
Yeah.
Let's keep things in perspective.
Let's keep things in perspective.
Okay, for instance...
Russia lost 20 million.
For instance, according to the official figures at Dachau, something like 30,000 people died in the 12 years... Inmates died in the 12 years existence of that camp. At Dresden, in 2 nights in February 1945, a figure estimated at around 250,000 by David Irving, one of the leading experts on the bombing. 2 nights, 250,000 people.
Germans.
100,000 people, 80 to 100,000 people in 1 night in Tokyo.
Yeah, we know that.
1945.
But we don't refute that, you see.
Okay.
I don't think there's any Hiroshima revisionists. I don't think there's any Dresden revisionists that say these people didn't die.
Well, actually, there is a kind of argument even about the Soviet figures during the war. But what we object to, though, is that we hear far, far more every day in our country about the fate of the Jews during the Second World War than any other people during that conflict.
Well, you got to admit, the Jews were kicked around pretty good during the war. I mean, as a people, even if the let's say we accept your premise that the camps didn't exist, well, the gas chambers right. didn't exist. You are talking about they're the only people who were uprooted as a single people and said, "We want you out completely."
No.
Who else?
No.
Who else?
Well, for one thing, a million, something like 14 million Germans were uprooted and kicked out of Eastern Europe at the end of the war, of whom 2 million died or were killed.
Okay, who kicked out the 14 million? Oh, the Germans came and, I mean, the Russians came and picked them up?
The Russians and the Americans and the British sat down at Potsdam and said, these Germans are going to be thrown out of their homelands.
Yeah,
where
they'd
lived
for centuries, yes.
All right.
In fact, Bill, the point is that you, for example, was a reasonably educated fellow, and millions of Americans have never heard about this. Or, for that effect, Stalin uprooted and deported and killed millions of people.
I know this.
And yet, we hear far more of Hitler's victims than we do of Stalin's, even though it's well established that Stalin's victims vastly outnumber Hitler's.
I think that's true. I think Stalin was, history is going to show us Stalin was
a big... Why don't we have any Stalin victim centers in the United States? Why don't we have any Stalin monuments or anti communist sections of the U.S. government?
Because
we don't have that kind of emphasis.
Yeah.
We have an enormous emphasis on the fate of the Jews in the Second World War.
I'll tell you, that's
a one-sided emphasis.
I'll tell you why I think, as a lesson to the Jews, and I will agree that Stalin was as bad as Hitler in many, many ways. I think, number one, it was harder for the information to come out after the war. The Iron Curtain shut down after the war, and nothing came out. And I think a lot of that, the Russian government did as good a job as any totalitarian government could to make those facts known to no one.
Bill, that's not quite an excuse, because the real emphasis on Holocaust mania, if you will, here in the United States did not really get going in this country until the 1970s, especially with this production of this NBC miniseries, The Holocaust. It was then that the big impetus began for things like the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council. Granted, there was some of this before, but the word Holocaust was not even common currency until the 1970s.
I don't know. I heard it bandied about ever since I've been a kid. Let's go to the phones. Tim, calling from San Diego. Welcome to KFI.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Tim.
Yeah, I keep hearing Ted and Mark fall back on the notion that since these atrocities weren't documented, that they didn't happen. But that's totally unacceptable. Because first of all, when people are committing war atrocities, they're not stupid enough to write them down. And in the second place, when Germany was being overrun, you know, fearing reproach, they destroyed all the evidence of these atrocities that they could. You know, so when they claim that they're scholarly professors who have all the facts and all the information, you know, it doesn't ring true. It sounds like a bunch of malarkey.
Well, you've raised a good point there, sir. There is a lot of documentation about Germany's wartime policy toward the Jews. There was a policy called the Final Solution, even. We have German documents about that. What is important is that none of this documentation, there is no documentation for any policy of extermination. That's clear. And the documents that do exist, and there are German documents, some of them were introduced into evidence at Nuremberg. These documents show that the German policy was one to expel the Jews from Europe, and then after the war, they were supposed to be sent to some other place completely different. Hitler himself in 1942 said privately to close colleagues that what he hoped was after the war the Jews would be sent to Madagascar or some other Jewish national state. I mean, there is documentation, and the documentation does not support the Holocaust extermination story as we hear it.
Furthermore, there's no end of atrocities, and you can't invent if you claim that the people who carried them out meticulously destroyed the evidence. That was what we were told about Auschwitz. That 4 million people had been killed, and the traces that people had been burnt down to ash and crematoria. At a rate of operation, by the way, 10 times that of any state-of-the-art crematorium today. It's nonsense.
Well, we don't have any crematorium today
that are
built to take thousands of people in per day. I mean, come on.
They didn't have any of them then.
Well, that's your argument, but that's a specious argument. Say, we don't have any crematorium. We could easily build a crematorium if we wanted to gas 2 million people. It doesn't take a genius to figure this out.
Well, the functioning and workings of the German crematoria during the war are quite well known. In fact, at all sorts of concentration camps, from Majdanek to Dachau to Buchenwald, the crematoria were abandoned intact at the end of the war. There was no need to hide the crematorium. I imagine that the engineers who designed them never dreamed that they'd be claimed to do away with bodies at 10 times the actual rate.
You want to say
I'd like to refer to something that Mr. Aaron Breitbart mentioned earlier on, and that's this Lucha report. America's top foremost expert on gas chambers used to execute criminals here in the United States on execution hardware is an American engineer named Fred Lucha. Fred Lucha was selected and asked to test to investigate the alleged extermination gas chambers in Auschwitz and Majdanek in 1988 for a trial in Toronto, Canada. He was selected for this purpose not because of any views he held about the Holocaust, but because he is the acknowledged American expert on gas chambers. He investigated the so-called extermination gas chambers at Auschwitz, Auschwitz I, Auschwitz-Birkenau, and Majdanek, and he concluded categorically that they could not have been used for exterminating human beings. I accompanied, a year later, I accompanied Mr. Lucha on an investigation of the so-called execution gas chamber at Mauthausen, at Dachau, and at Hartheim, and he made a similar conclusion about that. He testified under oath in this and has written a detailed report on this. Now, Mr. Breitbart earlier on was trying to discredit Mr. Lucha's findings. He's discrediting him. There's now an effort afoot to discredit Mr. Lucha because of his report and his findings on this subject.
I have a question to ask you, Ted. You're with the Journal of Historical Review,
right.
And there was a fascinating case in which several years ago, and I understand you weren't part of the organization at the
right.
time, so you're only talking historically here. Huh. I believe the journal offered a reward for anybody who could prove the Holocaust
Institute,
existed.
The Institute for Historical Review offered a reward for anyone who could prove the Jews were gassed at Auschwitz.
Why don't you move the whole thing a little closer to you?
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Great. Okay, and what happened was there was a gentleman by the name of Mel Mermelstein who presented some kind of proof. What kind of what did he present to
well,
you?
Well, he didn't present proof.
Well, what did he present to you?
He presented an affidavit purporting to recount his experiences while an inmate at Auschwitz
okay.
for one night.
And the Institute then said, that's not proof, we're not paying, right?
And then he sued.
And then he sued.
Yes.
And
the case was settled out of court after the judge declared that the Holocaust is a fact proven by judicial notice.
Okay.
An apology was issued by the IHR for emotional distress, and it was settled out of court. What's important, though, is that the matter of what the historical questions were not dealt with during.
Well, let me ask you, why did the Institute then issue an apology to Mr. Mermelstein? Was it a question of just staying alive as an
well,
institute?
It was part of the settlement, and it was an apology only for the emotional distress caused to him.
Well, what emotional distress, though? If he presented fact, his position that the Holocaust existed, you say no, it didn't, and the Holocaust didn't in fact exist as he described it. Why would you, number one, want to settle? And number two, why would you apologize?
Well,
because it was going to come up. There was every possibility that it would come up before a jury in Los Angeles. Mel's emotional hurt promised to bulk larger than the issue of historical truth, and the Institute might have been destroyed during this case. We settled at that point to avoid being financially ruined by court costs and a possible award. We apologized for any. As part of that settlement, for any emotional hurt we'd caused to survivors of Auschwitz, which we have no desire to do, and we've kept for the past 5 years, we've continued to challenge and investigate the Holocaust. We made no concessions whatsoever on that point,
okay.
Which is why Mr. Breitbart is so exercised about us.
All right, let's go to John calling first time from Santa Monica Mountains. John, welcome to KFI.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just curious about why these two guys got on the trip in the first place. Well, I don't mean what they're doing, but why they got what started them off on this trip.
Well,
okay.
It's a good question, gentlemen.
Let me talk a little about my experience. When I was 15 years old in high school, I saw a movie called The Mill of Death, Die Todesmühle. This movie purported to be a documentary about Dachau. In the course of the movie, statements were made to the effect that over 200,000 people had been killed in Dachau, many of them gassed. Pictures of the alleged gas chamber were shown. That was in 1964. In 1972, as a member of the United States Army, I traveled to Germany. I went to Dachau. I found out that the official concentration camp figures for dead given out by the International Committee, which runs the camp, which is not German. It's international, heavily Jewish. Their official figures were 30,000. They also claimed that the gas chamber, we dispute that it's actually a gas chamber, but in any case, they agreed with us that the gas chamber, whatever it was never used during the war. I was lied to. As a teenager in school, by a film, I became skeptical. about the Holocaust story, and I've never stopped challenging it since then.
Okay, that's Ted O'Keefe, the editor of the Journal of Historical Review. Mark, how did you get involved?
I first became very interested in this in 1978 when these aerial photographs of Auschwitz were first made public. And what astounded me at the time was that Eli Wiesel and some others at the time claimed that these photographs not only proved that people were exterminated at Auschwitz, but that the United States government was guilty of permitting these people to be exterminated and callously allowed them to be exterminated. I went to the National Archives. I bought a copy of, several books on the subject. I began investigating. I'm a historian by training. I hold a bachelor's and a master's degree in European history. I began investigating this, and in fact, the head of the military branch of the National Archives conceded that these photographs do not show what Eli Wiesel and others. And what astounded me was that if this kind of distortion of evidence could take place in 1978, many years after the war, it seemed to me worthy of investigating to what extent there was a similar distortion during and right after the end of the war, during the Nuremberg trials and so forth.
How many of you are there out there, by the way? Legitimately, let's not start.
Well, Holocaust revisionism is a worldwide movement, if you will. It probably has the strongest impact in France. A recent public opinion poll showed that a third of French people have doubts about the extermination story. The number of people who are absolute revisionists is very small, both in France and the United States and other places. But what's important is that there's actually a kind of official revisionism already taking place. Mr. Breitbart talked about it a little bit earlier when he referred to this big change in the Auschwitz figures. In recent years, this Dr. Arno Meyer, professor of history at Princeton University, he has come very close to the revisionist view on this subject as well. In all around the world, there are people, and the movement is growing. One of the most important, you might say, converts or supporters in recent years was British historian David Irving, who's one of the best known, probably one of the most popular historians in the world. A few years ago, he was not a revisionist. Now he is, after investigating it himself.
All right, let's go to the phones again. Christine, calling from Los Angeles for the first time. You're on KFI, Christine.
Hi. I'm just so disgusted, I don't know what to say. First of all, I'm not Jewish. I'm a black American. And I've been to one of the concentration camps in Germany. I walked on the courtyards myself. We were toured. It was a handful of students all over, United States. And we were shown what you said does not exist, a gas chamber.
How do you know it was a gas chamber?
I've seen it, yes.
Where were you, ma'am?
I was one of the Auschwitz. I can't pronounce it very much.
You were at Auschwitz?
Yes. Let me finish, please. And I'm trying to say, I'm not trying to be emotional. This is what I've seen and touched and with my five senses. I've seen one of these, what you say, fictitious gas chambers. I've seen what you say, fictitious ovens. We were told by the German people who were taking us around, they were used. The gas chamber were used.
Well, ma'am, if you were in Auschwitz, you weren't shown by Germans. Auschwitz is in Poland. It's run by the Polish government.
There's a few of them. I know there's one or two or three different kinds of one, but I did go to one of the concentration camps in Germany.
You don't know. You're not sure which one. It might have been Dachau, for example. You're not sure then which one it was. Or?
I went to about two of them, and I didn't want to see any more after that.
Well, okay.
The main thing I do want to say is I did see a gas chamber. Okay. I'm not Jewish. I'm not Jewish. I'm trying to.
Well, I don't want to sound cruel, ma'am, but I submit if you don't know what country you're in when you were looking at this.
I was in Germany, sir, Germany.
All right.
You can try to speak me all you want. I'll tell you what I walked and what I saw and what I touched,
right.
Okay?
Christine, we got to take a break. Hang on. We're going to be back. We're talking to Mark Weber and Ted O'Keefe, the Journal of Historical Review, Revisionists of the Holocaust. Bill Handel, sitting in for Joe Crummy. KFI will be back after this. Now, I don't want to be unfair to you gentlemen. We're talking to Ted O'Keefe, editor of the Journal of Historical Review, or Mark Weber, director of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. These are Holocaust revisionists. But we have yet to find someone who's on your side here. And so I'm going to make a call. I would like someone who is basically in agreement with the revisionists to call in and tell us why and give us your end of it. Because the last thing I want to do is spend another hour, and we are going to go another hour on this subject. It is a very emotional subject. Not only am I emotionally caught up into it, my family was involved in the Holocaust. Everyone on my father's side was a victim of the Holocaust. I had an uncle who was shot in front of my father at a concentration camp in Yugoslavia. My father witnessed the killing of many, many people at a concentration camp called Jasenovac in Yugoslavia. My father was one of the premier witnesses several years ago at a trial of a man by the name of Andrea Artukovic, who was the Minister of Justice for the Kingdom or the Government of Croatia, which was the Ustashi government, the Nazi government that took over Yugoslavia during the war. And my dad was a victim of his atrocities and testified and was one of the people most responsible for having this man deported to Yugoslavia as a war criminal, which finally happened about 2-3 years ago. He since, I believe, died in jail over there.
You should know, Bill, that Andrei Artukovich's son, Rad, who lives in this area...
Oh, and I know Rad very well.
...has succeeded in showing that the value of your father's testimony, that the evidence, the testimony used to extradite Artukovich was faked, and the OSI is under investigation from within the Justice Department, largely in response to Rad Artukovich's work on this case.
Maybe, but I will tell you that my dad witnessed the shooting of people,
mm-hmm.
and he's not lying about that. There'd be no reason for him to do that.
Well, we don't dispute that.
I don't know why, and you know, even if you did, I'm telling you, I mean, I have an eyeball witness who saw it. Anyways, we're going to continue on here at KFI. I gave you the phone numbers, and I thank you for not disputing that. I mean, you could, but it's certainly fact to me.
I may have been wrong in your father's case, but we trust you and we trust him. It certainly did happen in any case.
Right. Well, we
occasionally.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and go to Charles calling from a car phone in West Hollywood here on KFI. Charles, you've got about a minute and a half.
Make a quick statement. Basically, I think the American public and the world perhaps is very tired of, you know, giving a blank check to Israel and feeling, you know, how much do we have to pay for what the Jews suffered in World War II? And secondly, do you have a precise number of the number of Jews that you do think were killed in World War II?
Are you talking to me, Charles? Charles just went off the phone.
He asked about a precise number.
All right, so let's go ahead. I will give you my understanding is I am in the old 6 million Jews camp. I was raised on 6 million Jews, and until it's proven differently, I will go with the general perception. But please give me your opinion.
My own feeling is probably that the number of Jews who died during the Second World War of all causes is in the neighborhood of a million or a million and a half. The 6 million figure, in fact, is not really seriously supported now by responsible historians of this subject. There's a kind of an argument going on even among those who support the basic Holocaust story.
What happened to the rest of them? I mean, even assuming they weren't gassed.
Well, you posit 6 million people, and then you wonder what happened.
Yeah,
you say
people
say 4 million people were gassed at Auschwitz.
The
number is reduced to a million. What happened to the rest of them?
I have a question. Are you saying that 4.5 million people or 5 million people were just made up, that didn't exist, that these people simply didn't exist? Is that the contention here?
The 6 million figure comes from an affidavit during the Nuremberg trial. That's where the 6 million figure comes from.
You know what? We're going to come back.
Okay.
The last 2 hours and this hour, we are really going to take this full board this evening. We're talking about a subject that is not only controversial, but raises emotions to an extraordinary height among many, many people in our society. And that is the Holocaust. The first 20 minutes of the program from 7 to 7:20, we had Aaron Breitbart, the senior researcher from the Simon Wiesenthal Center, who spent 20 minutes basically ripping into and attacking the two gentlemen that are with me, Mark Weber, director of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, and Ted O'Keefe, the editor of the Journal of Historical Review. And the reason they were attacked is they are Holocaust revisionists, which means they want to rewrite the history that we know of the Holocaust and make three basic contentions. Number one, the German plan to eliminate the Jews during World War II did not exist. There were no gas chambers at the various camps to eliminate the Jews, and the figure of 6 million Jews that died in these camps is nowhere near the reality by many millions. Matter of fact, probably 5/6, if I might understand correctly. And on in studio is Mark Weber, who is the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust and also is connected with the Institute of Historical Review. And by the way, one of the reasons and the reason that Aaron Breitbart refused to debate these is that the policy of the Simon Wiesenthal Center is that they will not debate Holocaust revisionists. It's just that simple. They'll come on before, they'll come on after, but they will not debate head on. Gentlemen, did that pretty well introduce you fairly succinctly, fairly?
Yes.
Any problems with that?
I might point out that despite the fact despite the fact the Simon Wiesenthal Center claims to be too good to debate us, they don't mind using Holocaust revisionism in their fundraising pitches, and they don't mind attempting to not merely dismiss us and Holocaust revisionists, but to infringe on our freedom of speech around the world. The Simon Wiesenthal Center is for making Holocaust revisionism a crime.
Okay, I don't think the contention was they're too good for you, Ted.
Mm-hmm.
I think their contention is that Jonas Salk would not debate a voodoo medicine man on the merits of science versus voodoo medicine, and they think that the revisionism is simply such a bunch of bunk that it isn't worth debating. I mean, well, I think that was a contention that I got.
Comparisons like that are odious. The man came on to talk about his, historical revisionism. He was afraid to face us and talk to us head-to-head. Let listeners draw their own conclusions.
Let's go to Jerry, first-time caller from Los Angeles. Jerry, you're on KFI.
Hi, Bill. Great show tonight.
Thank you.
The thing that I just don't seem to understand, it seems to be a pretty much common sense issue with the Simon Wiesenthal Temple not wanting to debate them. First of all, I don't think the rabbi wanted to give them any more glory. I think, first of all, it sounds to me, and I wanted to ask Mark, as his background, he mentions quite a few times the movement, quote, the movement. Does that mean, when you say movement, does that make it a Nazi movement? Is that your expression when you're referring to Nazi movement?
No, by no means. In fact, interestingly enough, in France, Holocaust revisionism has been characterized as a leftist movement. I use the word movement loosely. It's not a very good movement. The pioneer of Holocaust revisionism was a Frenchman, Paul Rassinier, who was himself an internee, a concentration camp inmate at Buchenwald and Dora during the Second World War. He was a socialist, a member of the French National Assembly, and decorated by the French government for his resistance activities. He was the pioneer of Holocaust.
Before we built up the gentleman, I just want to move on because I don't think that's too relevant. But because you mentioned movement so many times, I was insinuating myself that you meant the Nazi movement.
No, of course not.
I wanted to clarify without getting this other gentleman's credibilities forward. I'm more interested in your credibilities. Now, are you currently a member of the Nazi Party?
No, I've never been a Nazi Party member.
Okay.
I'm not. The IHR is not a. The IHR, in fact, has run articles by a number of Jewish writers. The IHR is not the enemy of any ethnic, racial, or religious group. The IHR is a broad base. It has no political program and has no political alliance.
Okay. If you're bringing, for instance, Ted was saying that he's doing research and he has this book that he's gathering his facts for, and everything's supposed to be brought out to the American people, and this is for education, this is your so-called philosophy, this is what I've been ascertaining from listening to from the past hour. But what doesn't make sense is the United States government has sent teams of researchers to different camps in Germany and to many of the camps and sealed these files and have found different traces of gas, different traces of human, you might say, if someone were to have been dead and cremated in those areas, human excrement in these chambers, and you are referring to that as not possible.
You say the files were sealed, sir. When were they opened?
What are these files?
Those were files that were made public approximately 2 years ago on a K, I don't know if I can mention the broadcast station, but by a public broadcast. And from that point on, they were deemed not to be public information.
Okay, I know what you're referring to now. You're referring to these documents that came from the Soviet Union, probably, that were made public a couple of years ago, and their copies are now going to be available through the Red Cross in Baltimore. These documents record the deaths of approximately 70 or 74,000 people at Auschwitz. These documents also confirm the deaths of something like 300,000 people in all the concentration camps in Germany during the Second World War. These documents are extremely important. They are not consistent with the Holocaust extermination story.
Then why do they have gas pellet and other chemical traces of such a high nitrate level that could not be used for cleaning clothes or lice or anything?
Well, sir, I don't know quite what you're talking about. The America's foremost expert on gas chambers has investigated the so-called extermination gas chambers at Auschwitz, Majdanek, and Auschwitz-Birkenau. He has concluded, stated under oath, and has written the expert report to the effect that these chambers were not and could not have been used as extermination gas chambers. I don't know what report you're talking about, sir.
Okay, I thought you just said you did. But anyway, my final point, Bill, if I can go on one more quick point.
Sure, go ahead.
My parents, as well as probably your parents, I don't have my grandparents either, and there's, you know, hearing these people, you know, I've heard a lot of things come across KFI in the last few years, and this really got my goat to hear these people come on, and I think they're trying to pass themselves off as more as educators, but I think the general public should be aware of that. Just because of their nature of passing off and pondering off questions with such lack of answers, but they're they're just total...
Sir, in reference to, you know, to the United States government investigation, there was an Allied investigation of gas chamber exterminations at the end of the war. In 1948, the Allied Investigation Commission showed that stories of gassings, alleged gassings at Dachau, Buchenwald, and a number of other camps were shown to be false and based primarily on either extorted or testimony under torture or under lies by former inmates. Okay. This was a joint Allied Investigation Commission at the end of the war. They were not permitted to investigate Auschwitz. The Holocaust extermination story we hear today is not the same Holocaust extermination story we heard at the end of the war.
As Bill said, why would so many stories, why would so many people pass along to their children, young, innocent, male and female adults who are coming up into this world, who do not need to hear of a death?
Yeah.
Why do the stories get passed?
I agree with you. And Jerry, let me interrupt. You know why? You know, my dad telling me the stories of his family and the shootings that he saw. He doesn't have a political agenda here. He's not for the state of Israel.
He's
not looking for reparations. He's telling me historical facts.
No one says that your father is not true.
How about the other stories? The thousands of other stories, though.
Well, many of these stories, I'm sure, are true. One has to distinguish what is one talking about. What is specifically being said in this particular case?
Yeah, but you know, you're missing, Mark, if one story is true, there could be thousands that are true.
There could
be.
Let's prove one story about a gas chamber is true.
Let's start
with one, and not talk about thousands and tens of thousands.
Sir, another thing. You know, during this Vietnam War, all of us are aware of the terrible atrocity at My Lai, the atrocity of Vietnamese civilians.
Right.
I'm sure other massacres like this took place. That does not mean that there was a policy by the United States government to massacring Vietnamese,
though
very, very terrible things happened to lots of Vietnamese during the war.
You know what I think you're trying to do? I think you're trying to sidestep the whole issue, and I think that there's still a back of the bus area of people, sort of yourself, that would like all the Jews that are still in existence, that they, in your mind, says transplant it around that none of this happened, and like 20, 30 years from now will go by, there'll be another incident, and people like you don't want to see Israel get its own... I'm sure you want Palestine to get Israel back.
Hey, Jerry, I got to cut you off because we've got to take a break, and we'll let the two of you.
All
Jerry,
right,
thanks for the
Bill.
Call. And I'll let Ted and Mark respond to that if you care to when we come back. Ted, you were about to say before I cut you off before the break.
Actually, during the break, Bill, you asked about the unpopularity of Holocaust revisionism.
Yeah, I asked you if you guys ever got death threats.
We do periodically, but since IHR, the Institute for Historical Review, was founded, in 1978, we have had several arson attacks on our headquarters, culminating in the complete destruction of our headquarters and stocks on July 4th, 1984.
You guys still have insurance? Can you get insurance on the building?
We have insurance.
Oh, I'm just wondering how you do that after being burned a few times.
We've had people have fired shots at us. Revisionists have been, as I mentioned earlier, have been subjected to legal persecution. Many countries commonly classed as democracies. Revisionists, Dr. Robert Forson, a French professor who's one of the world's leading Holocaust revisionists, has been attacked several times. The last time he received such a beating... he was in the hospital.
He was almost killed.
He was almost killed.
You act like you're surprised.
This is a fairly unpopular
position you're taking here.
15 years ago, it was very unpopular to, once again, comparisons may be odious, but it was very unpopular to advocate homosexuality. 25 years ago, it was unpopular to advocate long hair. Are you implying that unpopular positions should be...
Well, what's more important is it points up, as you conceded during the break, the more enormous political potency and the emotional nature of this Holocaust issue. And the people who hold this view, people who say the earth is flat or any number of other ideas which are held like Holocaust revisionism to be completely crazy, they're not persecuted in this sort of way. It's just wrong. It's just it points up the enormous political potency of the Holocaust issue and its use in our society.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Guillermo calling from Pasadena for the first time. Guillermo, welcome to KFI.
Oh, hi, thanks. I would like to make a comment.
Please.
I've been listening to the show, and I'm kind of shocked by all these Jews who are calling the program and trying to cut any attempt to discussion or investigation by non-Jews about the Holocaust.
Why are you shocked, Guillermo? What do you want Jews to say?
Well, I'm shocked. I was born in Argentina, and I was raised in Argentina.
Right.
And
don't tell me. You're not Jewish.
Pardon me?
And don't tell me. You're not Jewish.
No, I'm not Jew.
What a shock. I'm surprised. Okay.
Oh, you are surprised.
Completely shocked and amazed.
Pardon me?
Completely shocked and amazed that you're not Jewish, Guillermo. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm Jew, and I'm proud of not being a Jew. But by the way, I don't understand why the non-Jews of America follow the propaganda of the Jews and make a taboo out of this issue. The whole thing is that I believe that Jews use this as a propaganda to collect money for Israel.
All right, that's a point, and thank you for the call. And I will tell you, you know, to a certain extent, the Holocaust is, we were discussing that during the break, is an enormously potent political tool used by Israel, used by organizations like the B'nai B'rith and the Anti-Defamation League. I happen to think it's justified, but I don't disagree that it is a very, very potent political tool, and it should be used as such. That's my view. Well, we finally got someone that believes with you guys, all right?
I think it's important to point out that there are facts,
mm-hmm.
and there are factual arguments, and there are emotions. And it's very helpful sometimes to try to dissociate one's emotions from factual discussions. I think, and Mark often points this out, I think it's a big mistake for Jews in America and in Israel and around the world to erect, and part of what Guillermo says is true, there is a taboo to a certain extent about criticizing Jewish issues in America. I think it's a big mistake to equate criticism of specific Jews or Israel or discussion of the Holocaust with some mad desire to want to kill off the Jews, as Jerry, the earlier caller, said.
I think that's the issue. I think we're finding more and more criticism of Israel. I mean, that's legitimate.
Well, there's another aspect of it, too, that no matter what, you might say it's legitimate maybe for Jews to do this, but what's not legitimate is for the United States government to become involved in it. What's not legitimate is that this becomes a tool used by our government and by our society. It has a centrality in our society that is entirely illegitimate. It's not right to make the partisan concerns of one group concerns of everybody in this society.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Kirk, who says he has evidence of the Holocaust. Kirk, you're on KFI.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. You have to speak a little bit up, please.
Sure.
There you go.
I am not a historian, and so I you know, don't have documents in front of me. But I just wanted to point out that are you gentlemen familiar who Victor Brock was?
Yes.
You know, Brock was a member, for the listeners, Brock was a member of Hitler's chancellery. At Nuremberg, Brock testified that there was no secret that the final solution implied the extermination of Jews.
No, wait a minute. No, every German official who testified at Nuremberg, it's astounding, but...
Gentlemen, you've been talking, let me just make my case, and then you certainly have an opportunity to speak the rest of the evening.
Fine.
You know, also, Rudolf Hess, who was the commandant at Auschwitz for a period, testified that Himmler had told him that first of all, Auschwitz was the site of the extermination of Jews, and that Himmler had chosen it because of its remote location and its close location to the rail system, which facilitated the importation of people for mass execution.
Right. Can I answer your point now, please?
Well, let me just. I'll.
So why don't we go? All right. Tell you what,
I'll
Kirk.
I'll be quick about it. But
right. Let's go. Let's go through your points, and I'll let Mark go ahead and refute each one.
Look.
The other thing, though, is that in a correspondence in April of 1943, Himmler's secretary wrote that the Führer did not want any published reference to the extermination or to the final solution, that this was supposed to be a clandestine operation on behalf of the Nazis.
All right.
Now let me just sum up in saying, I have no, you know, in terms of reparations, you know, it is 50 years, and we have to look to the future, you know, and we cannot hang guilt upon a people. And I would also say, though, that I'm very concerned by a comment that one of you gentlemen made much earlier on that more or less implied that Jews were holding the world hostage because they were using this Holocaust thing and they were getting concessions from the United States government, which I think is ludicrous because, I mean, as a minority, I think that Jews are one of the least favored minorities, although I do accept that Jews entertain a certain amount of business and political power in this country and have been very successful at using those avenues to promote Jewish causes. And I do have to say that I am also very much ashamed that the Wiesenthal Center did not debate you this evening, because I think the way you bring fact out in history is through open discussion and not through refusing to meet in an open and a fair forum. Finally, I have to say is that I am somewhat concerned that perhaps there are people who try to use the Holocaust as a political chip, and I think in doing so, what you're doing is you are weakening the enormity of that crime. And I just want to point out to other KFI listeners that this is an issue that not only affects Jews, but also, you know, there were certain ethnic minorities in Europe that were massacred. There were, you know, the Gypsies. There were other Slavic minorities. Homosexuals, intellectuals,
all right, Kirk,
dissidents.
We got to cut you off. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're going to have to take a break. We're going to come back, and Mark, we're going to let you refute. I assume you took the notes, and we're going to come back, and we're going to let Mark refute every allegation, every comment that Kirk made. Thanks a lot, Kirk. That was a great call. Now, before we went to the break, Kirk was on the phone, and he had some pretty powerful statements, and I believe, Mark, you took notes. Would you please refute them, but instead of just arguing, would you please give Kirk's statement and then come back and do a refutation?
Well, Kirk raised a number of points. I mean, okay. He raised very disparate points, but one of them I agree with. He said that the Holocaust is used as a political weapon in our society. I don't think there's any question of that, and we also take the view that that's illegitimate. That's wrong. Specific things he brought up, well, he did mention a 1943 document by Martin Bormann, Hitler's secretary, which did forbid the German press to talk about or speculate about the treatment of the Jews during the war, and that's true. It didn't talk about extermination. That's not true. Kirk mischaracterized that document. What Bormann apparently wanted to do was prevent getting any complex discussion in the German media during the war about what would be the fate of the Jews after the end of the war. But the most important point he probably raised was the so-called confession or testimony of Rudolf Höss, the Auschwitz commandant, who claimed at Auschwitz that he was personally responsible for the extermination of 2.5 or 3 million Jews at Auschwitz during the time that he was commandant of that camp. He also made this statement in some very well highly touted statements or affidavits that have been widely quoted ever since. What's important is that we now know that the Höss confessions were extorted by torture, that he was tortured at the end of the war when he was captured by 5 British officers. The man who led the torture session, a British military police officer named Bernard Clark, boasted about this later in a memoir, and that no historian now accepts numerous aspects of Höss's so-called confession. No serious historian, as Aaron Breitbart with the Simon Wiesenthal Center said at the beginning of this program, now accepts that anything like 2.5 million of anybody, Jews or anybody, were killed at Auschwitz during the Second World War. His statement that Höss's contention that there was a extermination policy begun in 1941, that he was commissioned by Himmler to carry this out, that's now admitted also to be untrue. Anyway, the point is that this Höss statement is a central pillar of the Holocaust extermination story. It's now discredited. It's now known to be untrue.
All right, let's take another phone call or two. Charlene, calling from Los Angeles. You're on KFI. Hello, Charlene.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
All right, I disagree wholeheartedly with Mark Weber and Ted O'Keefe, and I too have studied the Holocaust. And you can kill an awful lot of people in 12 years. Dachau opened in 1933. And it ran until 1945.
What's the death toll of that camp?
12 to 20 concentration camps in Germany during that time. The only one where anybody walked away alive was one called Ravensbrück. And I support Mr. Breitbart. I know he's dedicated. And I know he's a scholar.
Let's talk for a moment about Dachau. Simon Wiesenthal himself said in 1975 there were no extermination camps on German soil. The Holocaust story today is that there were 6 extermination camps: Auschwitz, Majdanek, Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor, and Chełmno.
And Mauthausen.
No, Mauthausen, ma'am, is now said not to be an extermination camp.
You're saying it.
No, but wait a minute.
I agree with Mr. Breitbart.
Mr. Breitbart,
you should get your facts straight.
Mr. Charlene.
I can say get your facts straight.
Charlene.
The only one that anybody walked away from was Ravensbrück.
There were tens of thousands of survivors at Dachau.
There were tens of thousands of survivors at Mauthausen. There's tens of thousands of survivors of Auschwitz. There's tens of thousands of survivors at Buchenwald.
After 12 years?
Wait a minute. It's now the number...
I'm getting off the phone. I wouldn't even give you the courtesy to talk to you.
All right. Charlene. Madam, we now know that approximately 30,000 people died in Dachau. The vast majority of these people died during the final months of the war. That's well established. There's no real argument about that point. Mr. Breitbart sort of implied that at the beginning. But what's important is that at the Nuremberg trial of 1945-46, in much of the popular literature, Dachau has been characterized as an extermination camp that's no longer held to be true. Even Simon Wiesenthal has admitted as such. The Holocaust story has changed a great deal over the years, but the importance of these changes is usually not talked about. That is, much so-called evidence, eyewitness testimony and so forth about extermination that was once accepted for these now discredited stories is no more reliable than the evidence that's now accepted.
All right, let's go to Renee calling from Pasadena. Hi, Renee, you're on KFI.
Hi. Good evening, Bill. I'm calling not as a Jew, but as an American Indian, and what I want to do here is to point out the process that's going on here. It's the process of all oppressors. It's the process of Goebbels, where he would repeat the lie and then it became the truth. And it's the process throughout history of discounting human reality and human experience. And that's exactly what Mr. Weber and Mr. O'Keefe are doing. And I think it's they're very slick in their approach and their pseudo-intellectual, I think, approach. And in quoting the fringe elements and in putting themselves up as authorities, but nonetheless, I think it's inherently repugnant and I'm outraged at the evil that goes on.
You know, thanks, Renee. You know what's interesting is that there's a gut level reaction to this, and I have to tell you that I've been listening to all this. Not too many people are coming up with any factual disputes for what you're saying. Most of us don't have the facts at our hands. I certainly don't. That's why Kirk brought up a very good point. I wish that the people from Simon Wiesenthal would be here, because they certainly have facts at their hands and could argue a much more intellectually based argument with you. And I don't know, my guess is you folks have a much better time arguing when people know the facts.
Yes.
You can really get into it.
It's very telling that the people who claim to have the facts refuse to debate with us.
I find that, the emotions run very, very deep here. You're probably talking one of the deepest running emotional subjects that you can think of.
Bill, that's all the more reason why we should be as sober and as factual as we can on this subject.
But I'm fascinated by just the gut level wrenching reaction of what is going on here. Okay, let's go on and find out if we can find some people who have some refutations, other than just this gut level. And I have the same reaction these people do, gentlemen, I have to tell you. You know, I am upset, I am incensed, I am screaming at you here, inside, going, you know, what the hell are you doing? And I'm not real comfortable with what's happening here.
You see, you've been trained to react that way.
I don't know if I've been trained to react that way. Certainly, I have been conditioned to react that way because of the information that I have. But the whole world, mainly, I believe, thinks this way. There's a let me go. Go ahead. You had
very few Americans of my generation, or certainly my parents' generation, are stricken with this gut-level horror and revulsion when we talk about the mass bombings against civilians of Japan, where whole cities were just laid waste.
Right.
80, 90,000 people were just cooked in a single night.
The previous speaker talked about propaganda. Well, there's no aspect, no chapter of modern history that is as politicized, as propagandized as the Holocaust extermination story. We have an endless ream of motion pictures, books, movie articles about this aspect of history. As you yourself conceded earlier on this program, Stalin's victims vastly outnumber Hitler's, but we don't find anything near the amount of propaganda about that as we do about Hitler's victims.
No, because there aren't lots of Russians here who came out of that.
That shouldn't prevent the production of docudramas and miniseries on television.
Let's go to Bob, first-time caller from Lakewood. Bob, you're on KFI.
Hello, Bill. How you doing?
Good.
First of all, I'd like to say that you know, this phenomenon of revisionism is not unique with respect to the Nazis. It also goes on with respect to Stalin's mass murders. There are historians out there like Jerry Howe who have tried to minimize the number of victims of Stalin. There's a, you know, a debate, I put it in quotation marks, about how many people Stalin killed. I think that this historical revisionism with respect to the number of Nazi victims, this kind of history bears the same relationship to true history as pseudoscience does to science. You know, if you go to the college libraries, you can see books in the physics sections that are titled things like Overthrow Einstein and Reshape Newton's Laws. You know, you look through them, and the ordinary civilian or non-scientist, let's say, perhaps can't tell whether or not what he's looking at is science or pseudoscience. Quite a bit has been written in the way of refutation of these Holocaust revisionists that have appeared in magazines that anybody can read at their local library. I'd like to mention a couple of them, if possible.
Sure.
Okay. There's an article called Lies About the Holocaust by the eminent historian of the Holocaust who just died, Lucy DeWittowitz, in the December 1980 issue of Commentary. There's an article called The Denial of the Dead on the Faurisson Affair, the French historian, who's not really a historian, he's a professor of literature, that appeared in the journal Dissent, fall 1981. And there's also an article called The Men Who Whitewash Hitler in the British magazine New Statesman, 2 November 1979. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's really interested in reading the other side of this can go to their library and read these articles.
And the other side being the traditional view of the Holocaust.
Well, not so much the traditional view of the Holocaust, but an analysis of, as they put it, this worldwide movement to deny that the Holocaust occurred.
Got it.
As so, traditional history says it did, with approximately the number of victims killed in the way that they were killed.
All right, Bob. Let me let you go. Real quick, because we have to take a break, Ted.
I would like the gentleman, since he was interested in supplying bibliography, to name one lie and refute it on the basis of his reading. And I would like to ask him if there are many books refuting revisionism in libraries, isn't it just that there should be many revisionist works to consult in those libraries as well?
I want to ask you that about the number of books that are out there when we come back on KFI. This is Bill Handel sitting in for Joe Crummy. We're coming back after this.
Ted, did you want to refute the last call, or do you want to take another phone call?
No, I think I spoke to
all right.
You before we spoke.
Okay, let's go to Marcus calling from Los Angeles. Marcus, you are on KFI.
Yes, I just wanted to make a couple of quick comments.
Sure.
One is that in terms of the Jewish Holocaust and visited upon them by the Nazis, one thing that the Jewish community has never discussed in a public way is the Zionist complicity in the Nazi Holocaust.
Oh, you want to tell me what the Zionist complicity was in this?
Complicity in the Nazi Holocaust is that they prevented the international worldwide Jewish organizations from intervening into the domestic affairs of Germany at that time, and actually helped facilitate the Nazis in their destruction of the Jews, such that they could get their hands on Palestine.
Okay.
Because the whole entire situation helped them.
All right, Marcus.
Never discussed.
Mark is nodding his head.
Well, there's a couple of points to be made about that. One point is, first, it is true that Zionist organizations did prevent some of the relief efforts that were possible during the war to help Jews in Europe. That there is some truth to that. Another thing that's quite interesting is the Simon Wiesenthal Center has welcomed to its offices none other than Yitzhak Shamir, the present Prime Minister of Israel. During the 1940s, he was a leading member of the Stern Gang, a major Zionist terrorist group.
Yeah.
Yes, this organization in 1940 actually made an offer of a military alliance with Nazi Germany, because for the Stern Gang and for Yitzhak Shamir, their main enemy was the British, and he was willing to make an offer of collaboration with Nazi Germany during that period of time. Yitzhak Shamir has a long and well-documented record as a terrorist. The Simon Wiesenthal Center considers him a great guy, a person that they rolled out the red carpet for at their organization. They have the audacity to make all sort of criticisms of the IHR. are when that's their record.
It's important to note, too, that years before the war started, the Nazis and the Zionists had a more or less de facto collaboration whereby tens of thousands of Jews were allowed to immigrate from Germany to Palestine with considerable amounts of capital, which was quite rare for any immigrants during the 1930s because currency and goods were carefully controlled.
Right. This pact was called the Ha'avara Agreement or the Transfer Agreement and operated from 1933 until the war prevented it to be carried out, whereby the German and Zionist organizations, the Third Reich and the Jewish Agency, collaborated in the systematic transfer of Jews to Palestine.
Was Germany being paid per person on this transfer?
No.
Was it a money-making scheme by the German government?
There was a scheme whereby, see, the British at that time prevented Jews from immigrating into Palestine if they didn't have at least £1,000, which was a considerable amount of money at that time. And the Ha'avara Agreement permitted Jews to transfer their money through a rather complicated scheme, which allowed them then to immigrate into Palestine.
Right. Marcus, thanks for the call.
Another fallacy that the Jewish community makes is that they speak of the Jewish community as a whole without distinguishing between Ashkenazi Jews, Sephardic Jews, and whatnot. And they also refer to Jews in terms of as if a minority or a race, and I thought that they were more in line of a religious.
Marcus, we're not going to get into the discussion of whether Jews are a religion or a race. Let me tell you, Jews get into that discussion for weeks at a time and can't get into that, so don't worry about that. All right, let's go to Fabria calling from Encino. It's Fariba, right?
Yes, Fariba.
Hi, Fariba. Welcome to KFI.
Thank you. Before I ask my question, I have two comments. You called Ishaq Shamir a terrorist. He's not a terrorist. His quote-unquote terrorism was different from like a Palestinian terrorist because Ishaq Shamir and his friends, they were fighting military men. They weren't fighting...
Wait a minute, ma'am. One of Shamir's most famous assassinations was the assassination of Count Volker Bernadotte, the Swedish United Nations peace envoy in 1948. He was assassinated because he was working on a peace settlement between the Palestinians and Palestinian Jews at that time. Yitzhak Shamir was also involved in the Deir Yassin, or his organization was involved in the Deir Yassin, a killing of Palestinians in the King David Hotel bombing, and in the assassination in 1944 of Lord Moyne, the British Middle East envoy in Cairo.
I'd like to say that not every country has a Nobel laureate, Menachem Begin, as prime minister, who was succeeded by a man who killed another Nobel laureate, Yitzhak Shamir.
Okay, so if that's the way you handle it, tell me when George Washington was fighting for the independence of America, who did he fight?
British soldiers.
Huh?
British soldiers.
All right. Fariba, do you have a comment to make other than the questions?
Okay, I want to know, why do these people think that Jews are doing this? Why, if Jews think it was 6 million, I mean, you're saying it's just 1 million. Why do we want to make it 6 million?
All right, would you answer that question? Could you do that in about 10 or 15 seconds?
Well, the main point, I suppose, here is that as Bill has said and as other speakers have said and we have said, the Holocaust story is a political weapon in our society. It's become as one Jewish American historian, Alfred Lilienthal, calls it Holocaustomania. It's used as a political bludgeon. It's involved with the United States government, with our media.
Ted?
And, of course, there's a point of historical fact. It'd be worthwhile, since one always hears a figure bandied around, to find out what the best estimate of it is.
All right. Are you involved with political movements of any kind?
No.
We already asked whether you were involved in the Nazi movement at all, and you said no. Are there any other politicized movements, left or right wing, that you were hooked up with?
No. Historical revision is very heterogeneous. We have libertarians, we have anarchists, we have leftists, we have far rightists. A whole mix.
You don't have many Jews, I'll bet.
There have been, I think, four contributors to the Journal of Historical Review over the years.
Four Jewish contributors?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And there are, we understand, there are Jewish academics who are at least closet Holocaust revisionists.
All right, let's go to another phone call. We still have another 2-3 minutes to go, so I'm going to take David calling from a car phone in Beverly Hills. David, you're on KFI.
Yes, I just want to commend you, gentlemen, on your courage in presenting this, because I'm sure you're getting a lot of flack, because I've noticed in this country, anytime you level any criticism at Israel or Jews, you're immediately called a Nazi and an anti-Semite.
That's my comment. And the other question is, and if you haven't answered it, how many German civilians or Germans died in World War II?
All right. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, well, most historians say that something like 5.5 million Germans died during the Second World War, were killed during the Second World War. It's interesting that many of them, of course, were killed in bombings of German cities during the war. That is, literally holocausted, literally burned up. An interesting point. But we hear far more, of course, as I mentioned earlier, about the fate of the Jews in Europe during the Second World War than any other single person during the Second World War.
All right, let's go to Daniel, calling from Studio City. Daniel, welcome to KFI.
Hi, I have a very brief comment. Something your two guests did earlier, I think, was very, very telling and angered me quite a bit. There was a caller earlier who referred to a document, a Soviet document, I believe it was, which he believed supported the Holocaust theory, and you said at first you were familiar with it. Then he said in the document it talked about gas pellets which had such a high nitrate content that they could only be used for extermination, and your two guests just dismissed it. They didn't ask him to identify the document. They didn't ask him to send them a reprint or whatever.
Sir, I ask him.
I find that you're a couple of pedagogues with an agenda.
Sir, please. At first I thought he was referring to some Soviet documents that were made available 2 years ago. That he said that he used this two-year figure. When I ask him, I would like to know what document he is specifically referring
to. Aaron Breitbart, I would like to know, too.
Why didn't you ask him for it?
I did ask him what document he was specifically referring to, and he said he didn't know. He couldn't remember exactly.
He did not say he didn't know.
Well, he didn't know. Yes, he did. You
weren't familiar with it.
Sir, he said that he didn't remember precisely what document he was referring to. I wish he had been specific. We all wish that.
If he had that proof, sir, it would have been all over the world by now.
Let's go to Pete. Pete, calling for the first time from Pasadena. Pete, you got about a minute and a half. Can we do it?
Oh, we'll try.
Okay.
I find it surprising that these gentlemen claim that there was no governmental policy by the Germans to exterminate the Jews. Real quick, there are the Journal of Hans Frank, the Governor General of Poland, referring to the necessity of annihilating the Jews. There are quotes by Himmler, an address that he gave at Posen in October of 1943, talking about how... Quote, among ourselves it should be mentioned quite frankly, and yet we will never speak of it publicly. I mean, the extermination of the Jewish race.
All right.
Goes on and...
Daniel, I'm going to let them refute, okay, because we got 30 seconds left. He came up with three specific quotes. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, of course, yeah. Himmler's speech is a reference really here to Einsatzgruppen shootings of Jews in Russia. There were large numbers of Jews who were shot as hostages, and et cetera, in the Soviet Union. Hans Frank specifically said at the Nuremberg trials that he did not know of any extermination of Jews during the Second World War. His diary, it does not say what you say it says. That's, I suppose, a short answer to that.
That's it. We're out of time. It has been an extraordinary 3 hours. I want to thank Mark Weber and Ted O'Keefe of the Institute of Historical Review. Mark, with the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. Ted, editor of the Journal of Historical Review. Aaron Breitbart, senior researcher from the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. And I thank everybody for the phone calls. It has been a very interesting 3 hours, one of the shows that I have felt more personally involved and more in tune with than many other shows that I've been involved with. Thank you, everybody. Have a good weekend. Bill Handel, KFI Los Angeles.